Good morning and welcome to First Coast Connect. I'm Ann Schindler. Today, a landmark verdict in the high-profile Maya Kowalski case. We talked to the local lawyer who oversaw the case and to the girl at the center of the Netflix documentary. Then, just ahead of holiday travel, the growing pilot shortage and what one local school is doing to help. Plus, what expectant moms can do now to stave off postpartum depression later. But first, a Florida hospital was ordered to pay $261 million last month over claims of medically kidnapping a 10-year-old girl. The high-profile case was the subject of the Netflix documentary, Take Care of Maya. It centers on what happened after the controversial methods used to treat a child's rare pain disorder were perceived as child abuse perpetrated by her parents. We're joined now by Maya Kowalski. She's the girl at the center of that case, who is now 17. She joins us via video chat. Welcome, Maya, and our condolences for all you've been through, including the loss of your mother.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined in studio by Ponte Vedra attorney Greg Anderson, who led Maya's legal team in the landmark case. Thanks for being here, Greg.
Hi, Ann. Welcome.
Maya, we'll get to the criminal case and the jury verdict in just a moment, but for people who have not followed your case closely, you were brought to Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg in early October 2016 for an emergency flare-up of your chronic pain disorder. You were 10 at the time. You were in a wheelchair and receiving treatment that included very large doses of the drug ketamine. Explain what happened over the next 3 months.
Over the next 3 months, there was an order issued where my parents were forbidden to see me. At a certain point, I was permitted contact with my dad and my brother, but only under heavily supervised circumstances. As for my mom, I was allowed to call her at certain points, but again, somebody had to be in the room monitoring the calls, but I never got to physically see her over the next 3 months. And as well, during that time, I was not allowed to get any of my infusions for my CRPS.
And you were basically in the custody of the state as determined by the courts. Is that right?
Correct.
So the hospital suspected abuse in this case, and they believed, Maya, that it was something akin to what's known as Munchausen syndrome by proxy, in which parents or caregivers sort of fake an illness for a child and treat them for it. You were only allowed to leave the hospital after a court ordered your release, and that didn't happen until after your mother's suicide. And again, so sorry to talk about that and to bring it up, but obviously that's a very central part of this case. She left a note that basically blamed the court system for the damage it did to your family.
Yeah, she did leave a note, and I definitely believe that the way that the court tormented her, as well as Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital, that's what caused her death.
Greg, Maya was evaluated by a child welfare agency doctor who specialized in detecting child abuse, and obviously you disagree with her determination. But how should people in that position balance their desire to protect children with the rights of families and the interests of the children themselves?
Well, are we talking about the perspective of the doctors and the state, or are we talking about the parents themselves?
Well, initially, the perception that the child abuse was being perpetrated was a decision made by a child abuse evaluator.
Sally Smith, yes. Sally Smith had an infamous record down there. In fact, there's a Second District Court of Appeals opinion that questioned whether she could even be trusted to make these diagnoses. And the essential problem in the case is that Sally Smith, who was board certified in pediatric child abuse, which is a relatively new board certification, she felt that because of that, if she could classify whatever was happening as child abuse, that she needed no more expertise in it. Now, complex regional pain syndrome is a complex a disease. It's one of the most painful diseases known to medicine. And you have to do a significant amount of clinical work to reach the diagnosis. And Johns Hopkins had already agreed with that diagnosis, but Sally Smith went in and told them, no, I think this is Munchausen by proxy. Sally Smith was not a pediatric psychiatrist or psychologist. She's not a neurologist. She was not a neurosurgeon, nor was she a pain management specialist. So she had none of the specialties that you would need to truly evaluate Maya. And yet she went forward and, you know, if you're a pediatric child abuse expert, that you're a hammer and everything looks like a tack. And so that's how this whole thing got started. But really, it was Johns Hopkins that maintained this and kept Maya in there for so long. And in fact, tried to develop a case against her while she was in there, unbelievably.
You and I spoke last summer, Greg, before the trial got underway, and you used a term I'd never heard before, medical kidnapping.
Yeah, I don't know if I coined it, but pretty close to it. And medical kidnapping is when a hospital decides that for whatever reason, they're going to drop a dime, as we say, on you. They're going to report you, which they can do and should do when there are instances of child abuse. But in many instances, particularly in the past, I would say 10 years, this has really started up, they are making allegations where there are very loose standards, very loose definitions. One of them is medical negligence. Another one is medical child abuse. And these have definitions that are so broad that you can literally throw anything into it. And what has happened is certain hospitals and perhaps not even the entire hospital, maybe just groups of doctors there. And I think more prevalently risk management services within the hospitals. If you're a troubling parent, if they think that for whatever reason you could be a problem down the road, well, making that call to DCF relieves a lot of problems because the parents shift from looking at what the hospital's doing over to just keeping their child. And so if you've got a parent who's saying, hey, you forgot to do this here, or why is my child getting worse when you told me this would make him better, one phone call can relieve all your problems. And so medical kidnapping is where these, particularly these terms of medical child abuse and medical negligence are used so that a hospital can take a child away by creating a case against the parents. And the next thing you know, the parents have a very long battle, legal battle, and very expensive legal battle to get their child back.
We're talking to Maya Kowalski and her attorney, Greg Anderson. Did you follow the trial of Maya Kowalski or have you watched the documentary? Do you have questions? We invite you to join our conversation at 549-2937. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can also message us on the First Coast Connect Facebook and Instagram pages or tag us on X at FCC On Air. Maya, the documentary that came out this summer obviously put a lot of attention on this case and on you personally. I wonder if it in any way prepared you for the even more intense spotlight that this trial brought. And I'm curious how you managed that. Obviously, just still very young at age 17.
Yeah, after the Netflix documentary aired, weirdly enough, I never got recognized. I felt like pretty safe going outside without, you know, somebody stopping me. But after the trial, it's a completely different interaction with the public. I mean, I get recognized almost every single time I go out. I feel like I have to get all dressed up before I go outside just in case somebody wants to take a picture. It's happened before. It's very interesting. I'm glad that it does have a lot of attention, the story, because I think the message is really powerful, but it is a little awkward as, you know, just a 17-year-old, you know, being out with friends and somebody coming up to you and asking if you're from the documentary or if you're the person from the court case.
And talk about the message, because obviously the circumstances of your diagnosed pain disorder, what happened to you in the hospital, are pretty unusual. So how does the case carry a larger message given the specificity of your circumstance?
Well, firstly, I think it's really important to bring more awareness and attention to rare diseases. I think it's especially important in medical centers like hospitals or just facilities, just to prevent, you know, just some sort of like misunderstanding from even beginning. The other message would be to probably, like, I would say there needs to be a lot of reform in the child protective services team, just so kids aren't stripped from their families off of a single opinion from some random doctor.
And the case required you to take the stand not once, but twice, I believe. And I'm wondering how you were, how your team helped prepare you, how your family helped prepare you, and how you dealt with that kind of pressure.
Well, I would say I didn't really get a lot of prep. I was shown pictures, and we did go through a series of just like family photos, and we talked about that. But I think just simple conversations were really helpful. I don't really like planning for talking because it just doesn't work for me. So I think just preparing in like that very simple way of just, you know, reminiscing of family memories or talking about timelines, that was important for me to take the stand and just seem prepared.
And were you personally surprised by the jury verdict? Did you have a sense being in that courtroom every day for, I believe it was 8 weeks, where the jury's head was at, kind of what they were thinking about you and about the case?
To be honest, I just prayed. I put it in God's hands. I didn't really want to focus too much on like where the jury's head was at, because at the end of the day, I can't control that. That's completely up to them. They're their own person. So instead of wasting my time worrying about, oh, what's going to happen, I really, really try to just give it to God.
Greg, I want to ask you the same question. This was a long trial. This was a really unusually intense trial. It was a very, I would say, heated trial.
Yeah.
So describe what it was like and what your expectations were as the jury verdict drew close.
Well, first, let me talk for a second about Maya's prep. You got to remember that Maya was deposed five times, and this litigation went on for 5 years. So Maya had lived with this. When she first came down with CRPS, she was 9, and she was 10 when she went into Johns Hopkins on that fateful October. So she'd lived with this thing for a very long time. But in the litigation itself, she got quite the training on the process, and the depositions were absolutely brutal. Asking her what we felt, and I think ultimately the judge felt, were completely inappropriate questions, and certainly things that you do not say to somebody her age, which at various times was, I think, 14, 15, 16. It might have been earlier when the first one went down. But in any event, by the time she got to the trial, she was pretty experienced about the ways of cross-examination and what they were after. The trial itself, from my perspective, was kind of a nightmare, but also a dream. If that makes absolutely no sense. Getting the case to trial had become a quest, because they had been able to play keep away with this for 3.5 years. Since the first time we tried to set it, or did have it set for trial. In the trial itself, we were very fortunate, I think, with the jury we got. They were very expressive. They asked probing, inquisitive questions that showed that they were following the evidence. They knew what the point was. And I got to say, in some cases, in Florida, jurors are allowed to ask questions. And so, It, particularly towards the middle end of the trial, when I was, you know, this thing went on for a long time, 9 weeks, and I was getting a little tired there. Sometimes I just ask a couple cross-examination questions and turn it over to the jury, because they were so invested in the facts here that their cross-examination was, I think, a little bit better than mine sometimes. And then I'd come back afterwards, you know, and fill in anything I wanted. But it was, I don't know, words. It's very hard to describe the amount of emotion that goes into one of these things. And did we know that we were going to prevail on this? I always felt in my heart that we were going to prevail. The big question was what the jury was going to do with damages, and were they going to agree with everything that we were alleging?
We've got a call. Peter on the South Side has a comment about medical care. Good morning, Peter. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Yes, good morning. I am not an expert, and it is not about medical care. I do have some familiarity with risk management. And my comment is that we live in a litigious society, so people are always looking over their shoulder, as perhaps they should, to be second-guessed. We're also in an environment now where people are very aware of child abuse, and you see cases in the papers, in the news, quite often where the comment is, well, where was Child Protective Services? These are obvious signs, etc. So I guess there's a broader issue here, and that is, you know, what kind of care and what kind of standards should be when you're concerned about child safety and risk management, because after all, if you mess up, there's a bunch of lawyers waiting to take you to court.
Thanks, Peter. Appreciate it. Maya, I have a question for you about that, just given all of the questions that were raised about the diagnosis you received. Did you ever have any questions or any doubt about the accuracy of that diagnosis?
Of CRPS?
Yeah.
No, I was very confident with my doctors. I mean, here's somebody who's dealt with it for years on end and literally has like a research center for the disease. I believed him wholeheartedly. And then for multiple other doctors, like CRPS specialists, to confirm the diagnosis, I mean, I feel like at that point, there's no disputing it.
We did reach out to the hospital and their attorneys to see if they had any comment or if they wanted to, you know, provide any information for this discussion. They didn't want to join the conversation, but we do have some sound here from Ethan Shapiro. He was the attorney for Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital in St. Petersburg. Let's hear what he had to say.
I think it's important for the jury to understand that what All Children's did was brave. They were encountered with a situation where their sense that something was amiss was up. Again, you have to remember that by the time Maya had come to us, she had been in a wheelchair for 15 months and had been subjected to what was unfortunately a massive amount of unnecessary drugs given at dangerous levels. So that's something that we would have reinforced with the jury. But I think they heard that not just through my closing argument, but from the dozens of witnesses who came to testify from not just All Children's, but Tampa General, Lurie Children's, and all of the world-class institutions that were involved in Maya's care.
So attorney Ethan Shapiro speaking there. Obviously, that was before the jury verdict, Greg.
Yes.
And evidently, they didn't agree. But there were a lot of questions raised about the nature of the medical treatment that she received prior to the hospitalization.
There were. But there was a long history with not only expert physicians who knew far more than Sally Smith and frankly far more than any of the physicians at Johns Hopkins, but a long history with Johns Hopkins itself. Johns Hopkins put the port in Maya's side so she could get the infusions. They later came back and complained were excessive and shouldn't be done. Johns Hopkins had been treating Maya for, I think it was 14 months before this, before she went in October of 2016. And they had a history that would definitively show, and did definitively show to anybody who truly was an expert in CRPS, that she had it. As to the treatment, CRPS, the defense tried to paint as a party drug, and that's something that immediately should put up red flags, was their favorite term.
The ketamine.
The ketamine, I'm sorry. And that the ketamine has been under study for 50 years. It was certified in the 1970s. and it has been used as an anesthetic since that time. The dosages that Maya received were larger than normal, but Maya had tried all of the other methods to treat CRPS. So you don't up the levels of CRPS. I mean ketamine, until you have tried all the other methods, physical therapy, psychological therapy, occupational therapy, opioids. She had been through rounds of opioids. And the only thing that worked for her were higher dosage than usual of ketamine. But the people who were administering it had been administering it for a long time, using this drug as a method to combat CRPS. Like I said, it's the most painful disease known to medicine. And so there's never been a death from it. It has a very high percentage of success rate. And most importantly, it worked for Maya. It put her in remission when nothing else had. And so had the hospital done its research, and I think they probably did do their research, they realized fairly quickly through the process they made a mistake. And I think from there, it was a narrative that they wanted to start and successfully carry through to the jury. Unfortunately for them, the jury rejected that.
We've got a call. Sabrina from Gainesville is on the line. Good morning, Sabrina. Welcome to First Coast Connect.
Hey, good morning. I appreciate you guys taking my call. I just wanted to call in and express what an inspiration Maya and her entire story has been for me personally. I've been following the story. I live in Florida here. I lost my father to medical malpractice, and I am unable to pursue because my dad was single, and I am over the age of 25, and I actually was at an event last month with a ton of people at a car show. It was my dad's passion. I had some of his parts there. I was trying to find homes for them because I am my dad's only child. And, you know, what am I going to do with all these Mopar parts? And I ran into a man named Scott, and he was so kind, and he listened to everything I had to say. And at the end of our conversation, he was like, Sabrina, I know your dad. He used to come up here on his red pickup truck and be at the same car show. And I just broke down crying. So I'm like, you're right. That was my dad. And he had such amazing things to say. And he reminded me that, you know, it's so important not to give up. And it's so important to keep fighting. And I think Maya is truly a classic example of that, that strength and that bravery, because it's not an easy fight. And I'm on it now. And I just wanted to thank her for that.
Thank you, Sabrina. Maya, what kind of feedback have you gotten generally about what you've gone through? I would imagine you hear some of both sides.
I do hear some of both sides, that's right. But I would say the majority has been positive. I don't really go on my social media and scroll through comments and read them. So if I'm on my phone and I get a comment and it's negative, that's the only way I'm going to see it. And most of them I just dismiss, because it's very evident that they haven't watched the trial or they haven't even watched the documentary. It doesn't really get to me, the negative, and I'm glad that it doesn't, because it just gives more room for the positive to fuel me.
And when someone like Sabrina has a message for you that you know, she finds the story inspirational, how does that affect you?
It makes me so emotional. I was actually tearing up as that was playing, and it's hard. It breaks my heart that other people have similar stories. But again, it just makes me want to move forward with everything.
So there's some legal battles that lie ahead. There is a hearing, I believe, a week from Friday that is going to discuss a number of things. But the defense in this case is raising questions about the integrity of the jury. Can you talk a little bit about that, Greg?
It's unusual, but they have gone after one juror in particular. We call juror number one because that was the selection process. He was assigned number one.
And the foreperson, is that right?
And ended up being the foreperson. And he asked probably the most probative questions throughout the case. But he asked them of both sides. And at the start, I thought that he was very pro-defense because of the questions. Really getting into, now, how can you prove this? How can you say that? And then when they had to prove their case, he was equally as inquisitive, let's say, of their case. There's nothing to these allegations. I think that they made up their mind that because his questions were so intelligent, knowledgeable, and were probing the negative aspects of their case, that they just decided he must have taken over the jury, and then there was some flaw there. And
they're also though saying that his wife attended the trial and ridiculous. Was posting on social media about the case in a detail that perhaps a spouse ought not know.
Yeah, except that we proved every single one of those that the phrases had come up in the trial previously. And so the whole idea was that the wife, that the juror knew about a particular phrase that could only be found on one of the doctor's websites. Well, then we proved that one of the physical therapists had used this term, creature comforts, in her testimony. And creature comforts is not that unusual of a term. And so a big part of their theory was, well, since he used the term creature comfort in one of his questions, that must mean he's talking to his wife. And that absolutely positively wasn't true. Judge Carroll asked the jurors every single time they came back, even for a 5-minute break, now, have you spoken with anyone? Have you read any media? Have you learned anything about the case? Have you talked among yourselves? And no, throughout the whole thing. The defense has really been chasing their tail on this one. And I'm very confident that the judge is going to deny that motion.
Maya, there's also a new recently filed lawsuit against the hospital. If you're comfortable talking about it, Maya, what is that about?
It's about another incident that happened while I was staying at Johns Hopkins All Children's Hospital. As Greg has stated previously, we have tried bringing it up in court. As a matter of fact, I did a proffer on it without the jury present. The judge didn't really want it to come in since the jury wasn't questioned pre-trial about that specific topic. It's just a very emotional thing for me. It's hard for me to get into, but yeah.
That's all right. Greg, what can you tell us about that Maya's comfortable talking about?
Well, there was an incident involving a doctor that came in without an escort and, let us say, disrobed Maya under some extremely suspicious circumstances. And other things went on. And we did not know about it. Maya, I believe firmly, had suppressed it. But we were able to confirm in some of the psychological records that she had tried to tell the pediatric psychologist there at the hospital about it and was shut down in that. And it wasn't until, I think, 2 weeks in that I had a conversation with Maya, and I said, now, Maya, you got to tell me every single thing, every single time anybody at that hospital touched you, no matter how slight or what the circumstances were. And finally, Maya explained what had happened, and I was horrified, absolutely horrified. But as an attorney and officer of the court, you don't just come in. I believed Maya. Maya has never misrepresented a thing to me. Was never caught in impeachment at trial. I knew that this had happened, but I still went out and found corroborating evidence in medical records where she had tried to say something about it and people had not followed up, and also found independent witness. And then I asked the court, can we bring this in? Because I had already raised, obviously, abuse as one of the issues and a battery count. And the court listened, and I think part of him wanted to bring it in. It definitely was part of this story, this circumstance, and what happened to Maya. But he felt as though the jury had not been questioned specifically about sexual assault mm-hmm. and battery. And he did not believe that that was fair. And so, and we made clear at the trial we were going to bring bring a separate suit. And we are. We have.
Maya, just kind of final thoughts here. This is a big settlement. What is your plan? What intention do you have to do with the money? What is your plan for your own future at this point?
Well, I think that I would personally really enjoy to use it for some family time, like vacations, and eventually moving out of this house. But we do have bigger plans with the funds. I think it'd be really neat to make a foundation in honor of my mom, and it would be directed towards CRPS and possibly victims of wrongful kidnapping from hospitals.
Mark called. He said he wanted to thank Maya for making her story public. And we certainly thank both of you for being here today. Maya Kowalski, thank you for joining us via video. Greg Anderson, thanks so much for coming in studio. We appreciate both of you being here.
Very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll be right back with what one local school is doing to help students take flight. Welcome back. With the holiday season really already underway, travel becomes top of mind. And this year, with several recent shortages of commercial airline pilots, we're seeing a lot of impacts on air travel altogether. I'm joined now by Captain Matt Tuohy, director of JU's School of Aviation. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And by aviation student Savannah Painting. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
To our listeners, have you experienced delays due to the pilot shortage? Do you have concerns about safety or suggestions about how to remedy the problem? We want your calls. Call us at 549-2937. Email us at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Message us on Facebook and Instagram or tag us on X at FCC on air. Captain Tuohy, your decades at history at JU dates back for a number of years, decades, in fact. Tell me a little bit about how you arrived and what it is that you do there.
Well, I arrived in 1971. I was one of the first NROTC scholarship students that started that program. After graduation, spent 27 years in the Navy and then came back first, right after my first Navy job, was the director of the School of Aviation. And now I've been back again for about 9 years. So it's great to be back at my alma mater, and it's great to be working with the students.
Jacksonville University's aviation program just celebrated its 40th year.
40th anniversary, yes, ma'am.
Congrats. And so what makes it stand out compared to other flight schools?
Well, I mean, we're very similar to a lot of the bigger programs, but we're a bigger program at a smaller institution. So, you know, we've got the same type of facilities. We've got the same type of airplanes as the famous big colleges and universities that have flight programs. But our students are a much bigger fish in a much smaller pond, which we find is the individual attention they get, the ability to know more people, to interact at a university level, really pays dividends.
Savannah, what drew you to aviation, and what stage are you at right now in your education?
So I actually just graduated with my undergrad in aviation management, and I do my flight training up in Anchorage, Alaska. So I'm about 20 hours away from my commercial pilot's license at the moment. And I initially got into aviation because of my father. He was a C-130 pilot for the Alaska National Guard. And he was the one who initially brought me into the world of aviation. So he has his AMP, so we would work on planes together. And when I was finally tall enough, I was 12 years old, he flew me up in the Pitt Special, which is a biplane that performs aerobatic maneuvers. And I fell in love with doing loops, barrel rolls, and pulling G's where your face feels like it's about to peel off. So that's how I initially got into it, and I fell in love with it.
So your father did stunt pilot as well as commercial pilot?
On the side, he did have aerobatics training in the Air Force, or Air National Guard, and he has a Pitt Special S2 model. So, yeah.
I have been up in one of those planes myself, and I recall being rather terrified. How did that appeal to you? What was it about it that drew you in?
For me, it was an adrenaline rush, and I fell in love. I'm an adrenaline junkie. I love doing just basically anything that gets my heart rate going. And for me, it was like my own personal roller coaster that you can manipulate, and I wanted to do something along those lines.
So, all right. And so if you're my future pilot on a commercial airline, I'm hoping you're not going to want to be like doing a roller coaster. But is that ultimately the trajectory that you're looking towards? Is that what you want to do?
So, yes. I initially wanted to go into the military, but my eyesight was a disqualifying factor. But now my dream is to later on fly for FedEx and hopefully one day fly with my dad and maybe do one of those trips with him. So that's my goal in the long run.
So he's still doing, he's still flying?
Yes, he is.
Okay. Yeah. So JU had the largest freshman class in the history of the program?
We did. We brought in a little over 100 students this past fall, which brings our student population in the aviation program to almost 300. We're about 290 now. About 240 of which are professional pilot students, and the other 60 are aviation management students. Everyone knows about the pilot shortage, but there's shortage in all levels of the aviation industry, and the opportunities for our students are just absolutely unprecedented.
Who do you appeal to primarily? What kind of student profile do you have at JU?
Well, you know, I tell people the freshmen that we bring in these days are a lot more focused and know what they want to do much better than I did 50 years ago. But most of them want to be airline pilots. You know, they've had a dream of flying, usually, you know, at least from middle school, many of them from high school. You know, but the majority now we're starting to see have been introduced to the aviation bug, if you will, even in grammar school. And they want to come in. We offer a little bit of a unique opportunity. The School of Aviation is housed in the Davis College of Business and Technology. So our degrees are business degrees with flight training added to that.
So what is the situation right now in terms of the pilot shortage? How does JU feed the need? And what is the current situation when it comes to shortages?
Well, I mean, there was a pilot shortage before COVID, and due to the circumstances, the airlines, in an effort to stay alive, if you will, allowed a number of people to retire early. And so that basically took a pilot shortage and made it even worse when all of a sudden the world opened back up and that sort of thing. Perfect example, our students will get all their ratings at JU, all the way up through flight instructor. Then they'll instruct for about a year or so until they get 1,000 flight hours, and then they can move to a regional airline. Now, in the olden days, 10, 12 years ago, starting salaries in regional airlines were about $25,000. They're almost they're a little more than three times that now. And right now, you know, if as long as you've got your hours and you're ready to go, and a regional airline will probably hire you, and you get to decide which one you want to work for, which is much different than it was in the past.
How do you get those hours? What is it that you're doing, you know, to get yours in place, and where do you fly?
Yeah, so I am currently getting my commercial pilot's license in Anchorage, Alaska, for during the summer times and whenever I have a 2-month break for winter term. Basically, I need 250 hours to be a commercial pilot so I can fly 135 operations or essentially I can get paid once I'm completed through that and I get my CFI, I can instruct kids who want to learn how to fly so I can be a certified flight instructor. You can gain those hours through doing that, or you can fly Part 135 operations, which enable you to do charters or whatever mission a certain company needs you to fly.
Mm-hmm. And one of the solutions to the pilot shortage that I've seen bandied about is the idea of maybe reducing the amount of flight hours required for someone to become a commercial pilot. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, it's a way to become a commercial pilot is there's a couple of ways. As Savannah just described, her path as an aviation management major doing the flight training on her own requires 250 hours to become a commercial pilot. Our pilot students get taught under a different paragraph in the federal aviation regulations. And because of the rigor of our program under Part 141, they get their commercial at about 110, 120 hours. So they're ready to become a flight instructor upon graduation and go from there. The problem with reducing the amount of flight hours required to be able to go to an airline is you're not going to have any flight instructors. At this point, they're all going to get pulled to an airline, and you're going to have a flight instructor shortage like we saw back before the pandemic, and the species can't propagate itself. You know, that at every point in the food chain, if you will, is critical, and flight instructors, you know, you need them in order to continue to bring people up through. So, you know, there's a big push now to get people there sooner. However, you know, you get dinosaurs like me that think they might learn a little something during that 1,000 hours that they need to get there that will make them better commercial pilots.
What about the idea of using flight simulators instead of flight hours to, you know, in a plane to get there?
Well, the airlines do that now. The airlines, the first time, first officer for a major airline is flying the airplane, there's people in the back. But those simulators are wildly expensive, multi-million dollar simulators. You know, we have a regional jet simulator in our facility at JU that is not certified like it is for an airplane, but it's amazing how much you can learn in a simulation environment that, you know, then translates to the airplane. So the airlines are going to be able to use simulators in lieu of airplanes. I think other operations are going to use simulators to augment the airplanes in the people's training.
There was obviously a big report the New York Times did about air traffic controller shortages. Is there anything that this program does to help alleviate that shortage as well?
In fact, we do. One of our tracks in our aviation management degree that Savannah is getting or has gotten already is an air traffic control track. We're part of the FAA's Collegiate Training Initiative program, which upon completion, our students are put in a different hiring pool to be an air traffic controller. So in the past, and it's a small program at JU, obviously, we're hoping to expand it, but I think we've had 6 graduates in the last year, and 3 of them got hired as air traffic controllers, which is not a bad batting average.
Well, we appreciate you guys being in today to talk about the aviation shortage and what JU is doing to help alleviate it. I'm Captain Matt Tuohy, Director of JU School of Aviation, and aviation student Savannah Panting, thanks so much for being here.
No worries.
Thank you
for having us, and appreciate you allowing us to tell our story.
For sure thing. So stick around. We'll be right back with One Psychologist's Plight, an effort to support new and expectant mothers.
Congarean Pen, dedicated to agriculture and culinary endeavors, offering field-to-fork dining and outdoor experiences on over 300 acres. Sip, dine, explore. Information at congareeandpen.com. LifeSouth Community Blood Centers, providing blood and patient services to the local hospitals, serving patients in this community. Donating blood with LifeSouth helps save lives. More at LifeSouth.org to find a blood drive near you.
You start your day with NPR's Morning Edition on WJCT News 89.9 because you care about news that's relevant to you. Think about all the reporting you hear from Mara Liasson on national politics, Nina Totenberg on legal affairs. Well, they both focus on the topics that impact your life, some that impact you directly, and some that may affect your future policies or decisions. You're listening now more than ever to NPR's Morning Edition. Make your contribution right now. Call 353-9528 or give online at wjct.org/radio.
Teach is a day-long conference created to engage, empower, and inspire teachers.
I have been so inspired by all the teachers and future teachers that we have at this conference, the Teach Conference in Jacksonville 2023, and it has been a positive day that has just really re-inspired me and got me really excited to go back into the classroom.
Early bird tickets are available for $40. For tickets and more info, go to wjct.org/teach.
House Speaker Johnson is facing fresh scrutiny about his opposition to equal rights for the LGBTQ community. We look at a new documentary that's giving voice to those who live in a part of the country where they feel like they don't belong.
Do we stay and fight, or do we go where there's stability and safety?
When families live among unfriendly neighbors, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
And we're back. The days and weeks after childbirth are widely recognized as fraught and potentially difficult times for a new mother, but new research has shown that the weeks before can be equally important in addressing maternal mental health and paternal mental health, and really improve the outcomes once a child is born. I'm joined now by Dr. Jill Garrett. She's mom to two girls and a licensed psychologist who specializes in perinatal mental health. She's also the founding psychologist and program director of the Motherhood Space, Baptist Health's maternal mental health program. Dr. Garrett is the founder of Motherhood Feels, a platform that offers more support for new and expectant moms and dads. Welcome, Dr. Garrett. Thanks for being here.
Hi, welcome. Thank you.
So you specialize in perinatal mental health. Explain what that is for people who don't know.
Yeah, so perinatal is a word that just means the period of pregnancy and the year or so after having had a baby. So whenever we have any sort of emotional health challenge during that time period, the period of pregnancy and the year or so after having had a baby, we are considering it a perinatal mental health problem. And we know that emotional health challenges can occur at any point in time, but that period of pregnancy and the postpartum period is just a time when we're more susceptible. And we know that as many as 1 in 5 moms, 1 in 3 moms of color, and 1 in 10 dads will experience a perinatal mood and anxiety disorder.
And certainly for, pregnant women, emotions are high. Hormones are really changing and surging at that time.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is a time, again, when we have a lot of different factors, biological factors, hormones you mentioned, psychological factors, social factors that create this perfect storm that make us, again, more susceptible to experiencing emotional health challenges.
And certainly stress just around preparing financially.
Yeah, there are a number of different social factors, things like changes in your routine. You might not be working, you might not be paid, and you might be having a harder time with all of those changes.
And so what does the Motherhood Space Day program do? Does that offer help for expectant mothers, people who've recently delivered? What services does it offer?
Yeah, I'm really excited about the program with Baptist Health. The Motherhood Space Day program is one of only about 30 perinatal specific day programs for moms who are pregnant and postpartum. We are actually probably the only perinatal day program that has all the perks that we bring to the table. So it is wellness inspired programming. We have trauma informed yoga. We have our full staff is perinatal mental health certified. There is free childcare, so it's really unique. So I'd encourage people who are pregnant and postpartum who are having any trouble with adjustment or mood or anxiety to contact us.
And did you have this level of expertise when you were having your own children?
No, I didn't. And this is actually something that I got really interested in after having had my own daughter about 9 years ago and recognizing that this was not a piece of the care that moms were getting. They were getting good medical care often, and babies were getting good care, but this comprehensive kind of emotional health piece wasn't there.
And was that something that you were looking for yourself at that time?
Yeah, so I found that I was a new transplant to Jacksonville. I had not a lot of social network at the time. So when I created this programming, I thought, what would I have wanted? How can I create programming that would have been nice for me and that I know works for the folks that I work with?
So talk about the Motherhood Feels platform. What is that and how is that different from the day program you're discussing?
Yeah, so the day program is within Baptist Health, and Motherhood Feels is a platform that I founded in an effort to really proactively help moms and dads and families to cope with their emotional health ahead of or shortly after having had their baby. You know, a lot of people I work with are really excited about having their baby, and that's great. And they're doing things like prepping their nursery, stocking up on diapers. And I want that to be a focus, but I also want people to be focused on an emotional health plan. So I created a online course and also some storybooks, and I've got a podcast, and where everybody is just kind of coming to the table to recognize it's important to factor in your emotional health too.
And does it help moms and dads connect with other moms and dads?
So the Motherhood Feels program offers an opportunity for people to log on to an online course. It is pre-recorded, self-paced. So it means you don't have to go to your doctor's office. You can just kind of roll out of bed and get some support right then and there and learn skills and strategies that work for coping and reducing risk of perinatal mood and anxiety disorders. The storybooks also have healthy mental health messages, healthy sleep messages, mindfulness messaging, and just lots of different healthy coping strategies to help, again, normalize that this is a hard adjustment, but there are a lot of good things you can do to feel better.
I've been speaking with Dr. Jill Garrett. She's the founder of the parent support platform Motherhood Feels, and also helping to put together Baptist's Motherhood Space Day program. Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate your work.
Yeah, thank you.
And that's our program. Join us Thursday when we explore a first-of-its-kind songwriting program that the school's premier art school is rolling out. And we leave you with a theme song for All in the Family in honor of Norman Lear, the television pioneer who died yesterday at age 101. I'm Ann Schindler, and you've been listening to First Coast Connect on WJCT News 89.9.
Boy, the way Glenn Miller played.
Songs that made the hit parade.
Guys like us, we had it made.
Those were the days. And you knew when you were there.
Dance for girls and men, women.
Mister, we could use a man like Herbert Hoover again.
Didn't need no welfare state.
Everybody pulled his weight.
G-R-O-S, our red great. Those were the
support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.